Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Brancinia, host for this weekly conversation about our place in the planet. We volunteers at KBOO are so thankful that the station is continuing to provide relevant information and wonderful music to help us maintain through this pandemic, and we're sure you share our feelings. If you value what you're hearing on the station during these difficult times, please consider becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership by going to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. This week, we are witnessing the confluence of the COVID-19 pandemic, economic collapse, and unprecedented widespread militant demonstrations expressing anger and grief over the death of George Floyd, the most recent manifestation of the systemic racism that permeates the United States. This confluence is a reminder that the reach of disastrous events is long and unpredictable, both for better and for worse. Alan Derning, director and founder of the Sightline Institute in Seattle, recently wrote, "The bubonic plague, according to historian Barbara Tuchman, hastened the Renaissance. The Great Depression gave birth to both the social safety net in the West and to fascism in Europe." Today we talk with Alan about the hope he describes in his article, that the long-term effect of the coronavirus pandemic will be to strengthen the importance of competent science and solidarity. Alan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
When we first talked about doing this interview, which was about a month ago, and you'd just written an article for the Sightline website about some very hopeful prognoses you had for what might be the result of living through this pandemic and what kind of changes it could make, one of them that really struck for me was your last theme was, "We're not going to the beach." And that was, like, I think, May 10th when you wrote that. Well, on May 23rd, things looked really different. And I just wanted to start by talking about how this pandemic and now the protests around the world actually are speeding up time and making our time frame so impossible to predict that I wonder how we talk about what's happening now, let alone what's going to happen in a few days.
That's absolutely right. It's a little bit like the experiences you know have when you fall off your bike or have some other accident and time seems to speed up or stop all at once. It's kind of like you have a peculiar experience of time, and that's definitely happening historically. This is clearly an inflection point in our history. We have a convergence now of three crises. We have a global health pandemic unprecedented in any of our lifetimes. We have a global economic collapse, again, unprecedented in any of our lifetimes. And now we have a political uprising triggered by yet another spate of murders of Black Americans by the police, or in one case by a former prosecutor. So, and all of this is happening at the same time. And what are the outcomes of all of it? Who knows? You know, I wrote the original article in late April and the beginning of May on Sightline. It's called "The Plague Brought Us the Renaissance. What Will COVID-19 Bring?" Because I wanted to think about not the immediate consequences of the pandemic and economic collapse, but what might be the long-term consequences. Like, what will be the changes that last 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years into the future? And I, you know, came up with some hypotheses about that I still think I hold to. But now we've added another crisis on top, and I, like everyone, I probably haven't fully synthesized what does it all mean.
Well, I also, speaking of time frames, I need to let listeners know that we were actually recording this on Thursday, June 4th. It's going to air on Monday, June 8th. And my experience from last week recording my show on Thursday, just before the protests started to take on the dimension that they took on all weekend, and then listening to it playing back on the air on Monday, it was almost like I was cringing, because what we were talking about on Thursday sounded so many ways pretty irrelevant to what was happening now. So I want listeners to know that we may be experiencing the same thing on Monday when you're listening to this show. Before we get into the broader picture, which I really feel is a very important place to hold on to while we're going through this, I'm just interested in knowing what your take is on watching the protests unfold. And do you have any idea why it's happening at this time with this kind of ferocity? Because this is not the first time that a Black person has been killed by the police in a brutal way, though maybe this is one of the more brutal experiences that we've seen unwind. But it's the first time that it has been embraced globally in the way that it has.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to Ta-Nehisi Coates talk about this moment and compare it to 1968. And he was somewhat hopeful because of the breadth of the protest movement in the United States and beyond the United States. And what that I think reflects is that while it's certainly, it's probably not a majority of Americans, but a much larger swath of Americans, including people of color and also a big chunk of the white community in the United States, has awoken to the severity of the policing crisis, the criminal justice crisis, which is, of course, just a reflection of the larger caste system we have in the United States. And why did it happen right now? I don't know. We live in a social media time, in a hyper-polarized time as well. And we've all been locked up in our houses and the economy's been collapsing. So things were already feeling all shaken loose, and maybe this was the final straw, or maybe it's just that this time we'd hit a critical mass. And I hope it will propel real change. You know, the horrible truth is that the United States has managed tenaciously to sustain its original sin of systemic racism through one rebellion after another, generation after generation. You know, I like to hope that we're making some progress with each round, but yeah, I don't think anybody can say why it's happening, but it feels like something really big is changing right now.
Well, I was reading an article a little bit earlier in the Washington Post about comparing this to 1968. And of course, that's where I cut my political teeth, was back in 1967, 68, when I was a freshman in college and was protesting the Vietnam War and racism at the university I was going to at the time, which was Columbia University, and the intersection of the war and racism. And so in some ways, there's a lot of similarity, but in a lot of ways, there's a lot of difference. And I think that one of the things that really resonates with me about how extensive these protests are, the New York Times did this really incredible spread of photographs a few days ago showing protests all over the country and in some really surprising places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and some really small towns or smallish cities in the South and the Midwest. And a friend of mine in Tacoma posted that list on Facebook, and I responded to some of the other cities that weren't mentioned. And then he started mentioning all these places in the middle of Washington State, I think Wenatchee, and, like, you know, places you don't expect protests. Well, the place that really struck me yesterday, I saw a march with about 1,000 people marching through the main street of Happy Valley, Oregon, which is this little suburban place where people had moved to, I think, from Portland because they couldn't afford Portland home costs or rents. And so they've been living in Happy Valley. And to see a place that I've always thought was just the epitome of apoliticalness have a march in support of stopping police violence against people of color struck me. This is how far this has come. And in a way, it's even more surprising to see these marches in these kind of suburban enclaves than it is to see them in small towns. But they're also now happening all over Oregon and all over Washington. Yeah, that's a real big difference between now and 1968.
That's exactly right. When I was working on the original article, and ever since, I've been thinking about this countervailing forces within us as humans. And there's the one force that is to band together against adversity, right? And to define ourselves by our membership in the community. And there's the other force, which is to divide, to pull apart, to other the victims of hardship and to somehow diminish them. And so the great question about how we respond to any particular, you know, collective trauma is whether we will take it as an opportunity to pull together, to make us stronger as a group, as a community, as a nation, or whether we will divide. And if you look at the response to the George Floyd murder and the other murders of Black people by the police, if you look at the response, what feels different is that it seems like a larger share of Americans see the victims as members of their community, right? We're having a response to this that is of greater solidarity, not of othering. Now, you know, the response from Washington, from the White House, is to try to stoke a law and order response, a backlash. And so far, that's not working. Now, there's still great risk. My father ran for attorney general in the state of Washington in 1968, and he was one of the liberal candidates, and he lost in the primary because of the white backlash to the riots that followed after Martin Luther King's assassination. There's good analysis to suggest that Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey in the 1968 election because of the white backlash to the 1968 uprising. And you can look back through our history and see again and again these kind of backlash responses. So I've been really anguishing over what the consequences will be, political consequences will be. There's so many issues that depend on political change. Where to make even, you know, stepwise progress, we need new people in office. But so far, my read, my guess is that that the pull together instinct is stronger than the instinct to divide. That we see George Floyd not as an other. That a lot of white people in America, including Republicans. I mean, the president has officially said that the crime against Floyd was unacceptable, but meanwhile, he's stoking the usual, he's uttering the usual dog whistles, rallying behind the police and saying that protesters are a threat. So I'm somewhat hopeful, but it seems like it's just way too early to know how it all works out.
Well, one of the things that I find is really different from the past and gives me some hope is this almost 180-degree swing on the part of the media in covering the protests. Because on Saturday morning, they were covering them like there were this wave of violence raging across America, the same way they would have covered all the black rebellions in the ghettos in the 1960s and 70s and more recently in Baltimore 5 years ago. And there was very little emphasis, or they would say what was started out as a peaceful protest. This is what the Oregonian said about the Portland protest Friday night. It started out peaceful and it devolved into all this looting and burning and trashing.
Yeah.
Now, particularly since Trump's military police ran rough over peaceful protesters Monday to clear a path so that Trump could make it his way to St. John's Church. In the aftermath of that, it seems like the media is picking up that the vast majority of protesters are peaceful, that the desire is for peace, that the outbreaks of violence are pretty sporadic and a very small percentage of the protesters, and that, in fact, we're starting to see more in the news, especially today, that the police are instigating a lot of the violence. And in a way that reminds me of a lot of what happened in the 60s, where the police did instigate, I think, most of the violence up until about 1969, 1970, and then I think the left, parts of the left became a lot more violent itself. I wonder if you're seeing that shift and what that may indicate in terms of there being a real major sea change in American thought and in the way that we maybe are understanding how inclusive our society needs to be.
Yeah, it's a great question. It is the question. And, you know, we're speaking on the 4th of June. Ask me again on the 4th of November. Right after the election, and I will tell you what I think the answer to that question is, because all the forces are working at the same time. There are things pulling us together and things that are pulling us apart. And right now, you're right that the media coverage in the last few days has emphasized the peacefulness of protesters, has emphasized the widespread nature of protests, have emphasized divisions within the president's party, has emphasized the rejection from military leaders and former military leaders of the notion of using the U.S. Army to put down peaceful protests. So all those are really good things, but it could swing again. And all of this, of course, is happening in the context of deep polarization in the American electorate. And two separate information systems. We have two different worlds, information worlds that people are living in. There's the Fox News network and affiliated networks and the social media and talk radio that that rallies the right. And then there's a more reality-based media network that or media system that includes professional journalism led by mainstream outlets and so on and so forth. So it's impossible for us to know what's happening in the hearts of swing voters in Ohio. I guess what I would say is that I don't think that almost anything can lead to a true sea change in the United States, but I do think that things can have huge impacts at the margins. And the margins is margins where it matters, because we are, in terms of the Electoral College and in terms of control of the Senate, we're very closely balanced. So moving 3 or 4% of people, or mobilizing 3 or 4% of people, can make a huge difference in terms of the fate, you know, the course of history.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alan Durning with the Sightline Institute in Seattle about possible long-term outcomes of the confluence of crises that we're now facing. I just feel every time I think about what's been going on the last few days, my mind just keeps getting boggled in things that happen that are so unexpected. And I think one of the things that really stood out to me was this Jim Mattis' response to Trump's clearing of the peaceful protesters in a very violent way on Monday, and how he's not just decrying that, but basically calling Trump a wannabe dictator.
That's right.
Do you see that him and that Lisa Murkowski has come out very strongly in support of what Mattis said? Mm-hmm. A lot of Republicans still are not wanting to be too strong about it, but do you see any little cracks that maybe give you a little bit of hope?
I think both of those things are cracks in the astonishing unity that Trump has succeeded in achieving in Republican ranks. He's been very effective at unifying his party. He's been terrible at uniting the country, or in fact at advancing his agenda. But When the leadership of the military and a respected military leader like Mattis speaks out, I think it does make a difference. And Lisa Murkowski is very encouraging to me. You know, her particular route to power in the U.S. Senate, though, has always made her an unusual case, right? She wins running up the middle in Alaska. She has her electoral constituency includes a lot of centrist and Democratic women, and she is often challenged on the right. As she first won her Senate seat, or held her Senate seat after she was appointed, running as a write-in candidate against a Tea Party Republican. So she has therefore somewhat more independence and somewhat of a need to separate herself from Trump. Anyway, I found it encouraging. It wasn't Mitch McConnell, right? It was Lisa Murkowski, who's he's the senator who is least tethered to the Republican Party of the whole Republican caucus. Now, there are two other U.S. senators who have spoken out against the president's clearing of Lafayette Park with tear gas and flashbangs so that he could go take his picture in front of the church holding a Bible. But we'd need a lot more people to split away from Republicans before I would really feel like the party was splintering. I think that the path, you know, the United States needs a functional conservative party. I am not conservative. I don't have a conservative bone in my body. But what Trump has done, unfortunately, is convert that party into a white nationalist faction that's motivated primarily by racism.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is prior to George Floyd's murder, the news was filled with all these protests of Americans around the country protesting the stay-at-home orders of their states. And there was a big issue, in fact, that was just settled by the Supreme Court about whether or not California had the right to ban church services over 25 or 50 people.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, those protests are, I'm not sure if they're still going on, they seem to be off the news, off the radar, and these much bigger protests, which in fact are far more representative of the American population. How do you see that juxtaposition?
The thing that's interesting to me is the degree to which the far right mobilized to protest stay-at-home orders, but they didn't even speak for the right. The opinion research suggests that until quite recently, we had 70 or 80% of the electorate who was completely behind stay-at-home orders. it's shifted a little bit. Like everything, the polarization is so powerful that the messages from the White House started to show up in public opinion polling in the U.S. So you'd ask questions like, do you think it's safe to get on an airplane? And pretty much everybody was saying no. About 2 weeks ago now, the opinion polling started to shift to reflect what the White House was saying. But curiously, while Republicans have started to say that they feel like it's safe to go back to work or get on an airplane or go on a vacation or whatever, they're not doing it. They're just saying it, right? In the places that have reopened, we've not had a huge rush to get back on airplanes to go sit and, you know, go to crowded bars and so on and so forth. There's, you know, there's some amount of it going on. And partly it's just inevitable that will happen. People cannot literally stay at home by themselves indefinitely. So I think that the protesters on the right did not spark any large movement. They did not speak for any large sentiment among the public. And I think that the media covered them because it was good footage, right? But I don't think that was a mass movement. I think that the murder of George Floyd and that unbelievably arresting video footage is a completely different thing. I don't think we'll have any records in our history about the white guys with weaponry going into the Michigan State House. But I think that the story of George Floyd's murder will be in the history books 50 years from now because of the enormous public response. And the public response is because there's a realization that that's not an outlier event, right? That's the reality of our country in 2020. And it's not okay. It is just not okay to a huge share of the public. And they're ready to act on it now. So God bless them.
I just wonder if there's any kind of connection in people's spirits or souls, and maybe in their minds, between the abysmal way in which this country has responded to the COVID-19 pandemic and the abysmal way historically that this country has responded to people of color and really brutalized them. Maybe that people maybe have been feeling in a way, at least mentally, brutalized by this pandemic and not really seeing leadership coming from the federal level. I just wonder if that in some ways might be intersecting in some interesting ways.
Yeah, maybe. Barbara, I'm afraid I don't have any deep thoughts about that question. It's possible that those connections are happening in people's minds, but it's also possible that they're not. People mostly live in the here and now. And in the here and now, it's not obvious to people it is obvious to those of us who are thinking hard about COVID and its interaction with systemic racism, that it, like everything else, is disproportionately victimizing people of color, right? People lower in class and people with darker skin are dying more, are getting sick more, are also getting laid off more. This is exactly what you would expect because every problem that comes along does that same kind of thing. In an article, I described COVID as like one of those contrast dyes that radiologists use to show you the inside of the body. And sure enough, the coronavirus is just like a contrast dye showing those who are, who have the least, who are most vulnerable, and it's people of color, and it's also older people and people with less money and so on and so forth. But are people making that connection to the Floyd murders and all that? I don't know.
This isn't something that we can speak about with any kind of authority, but I just have been thinking a lot about how I know for myself that this whole pandemic has really kind of changed the way I think in a lot of ways. It's changed the way I behave. I've certainly, on the most obvious level, I go out with a mask. And well, maybe the biggest thing for me is I'm not at these protests right now because I'm an older person and I'm trying to figure out how I could safely go to protests. But at this point, it doesn't seem like it's a good idea for me and my friends that are my age. However, there seems like there's ways in which I know that my whole approach to the world has really shifted. And I wonder if you are seeing that with people that you know in your interactions with people that you work with, that there is some kind of shift and that maybe is having some kind of impact on people being so much more sensitized to brutality against people of color in this country.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, I would have to speculate. I can say that just before this conversation, I was on a Zoom lunch with my family and I was begging my 85-year-old mother not to go out to protest, as she has in every other generational protests, since she was one of the leaders of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality in Seattle in the 1960s. And I said, you know, we have younger members of the family who can go to represent us, but at 85, it's better for you not. She grudgingly accepted that wisdom. I think it's really hard for us to anticipate what changes are happening now will last. And that was the inspiration to write the article that caused you to call me up for this interview, the one where, you know, titled that the plague brought the Renaissance, what will COVID bring? Because it's, you know, the world has changed completely for everybody. And this is that, you know, even before the economy was collapsing, right, there's never been a experience shared so globally, where all of a sudden one disease caused people on every continent and every country to change their behavior so dramatically. In the United States, you know, you had suddenly 40% of people just pretty much locked up in their houses, not doing much, and everyone else was dramatically reducing how much they were going out and doing anything. And the same was true in countries across the world. So completely unprecedented. And we know that giant changes like that, big traumas, big disasters, big threats, big new realities, change the course of history. Often the near-term consequences are not the long-term consequences. And I started my article by talking about Chernobyl. You said you cut your teeth on the 1967-68 activism. I cut my teeth in 1986, coming out of college, working in a think tank in Washington, D.C., learning all about the Chernobyl disaster. Chernobyl disaster had all kinds of big consequences in the near term on health, on the economy, on the nuclear power industry globally. And I was studying that for my first year out of school. But nobody anticipated what Mikhail Gorbachev wrote 20 years later, which was that the Chernobyl disaster would be the final straw leading to the collapse of Soviet communism. Now, it was a final straw. There were all kinds of other things that happened as well. But from his perspective, and he should know, he was there, it was the thing that destroyed the last bits of trust in the Soviet institutions and Soviet establishment. And he just couldn't hold it together after that. It had proved that the entire Soviet system was a cruel joke. It was a farce. It took 5 years for that to unfold. But, you know, you look back through history and you see the plague and the ways that it destroyed confidence in the Roman Catholic institutions and the primacy of the church and the state, and led to new freer thinking that hastened the Renaissance. You look at the Great Depression and the way it led to fascism in Europe and to the New Deal in the United States. One really terrible outcome and one really good outcome. The question is, like, what are going to be the long-term consequences? What are going to be the consequences that last of this triple crisis we're experiencing right now, of a pandemic, economic collapse, and now a new racial reckoning?
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibbutz Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alan Durning with the Sightline Institute in Seattle about the possible long-term outcomes of the confluence of crises we're now facing. Well, last week I was talking to Richard Heinberg, who's with the Post-Carbon Institute, and he said on the show that he felt like he could see America coming apart at the seams as a result of this. And then he emailed me later about he was writing an article about how this could be the end of the United States. Basically, in the interview, he talked about the end of the United States as a world leader, which may not be such a bad thing, but he's also concerned that the United States just might fall apart. Is that something that you see, sort of thinking along the lines of Chernobyl's impact on Russia?
It's entirely possible. You know, you can develop a plausible argument, a fairly strong argument, that that the outcomes of this triple crisis will be mostly negative. It will exacerbate division. That it will deepen the divides among us. We will other the victims. We will blame others outside of the United States. We will pull inwards and pull apart from each other. There's evidence that people respond to infectious disease by becoming more selfish, more protective of their own family, and less collectivist in their response. But there also are reasons to think we may respond much better to this, and that was the argument that I developed. Now, I don't have a prediction. I would be surprised if this leads to the literal disbanding of the United States. For one thing, there just isn't any political path to that happening, right? We had a civil war, and it settled the question of whether states can leave. It could lead to a much scarier outcome than a dissolution of the Union, which is a chaotic time with competing power centers and a highly armed electorate. It could lead to all kinds of horrible outcomes. But perhaps because I'm just a continental optimist and perhaps because this crisis seems different to me than some past crises, I have a somewhat more hopeful outlook. And that is that it will strengthen three things. It will strengthen the respect for competence in our institutions and our leaders. This is separate from ideology. I make no prediction about the ideological outcome over the long term, but that a strengthened regard for competence, an elevated role for science in our public life and in our institutions, and third, a stronger sense of solidarity with each other. Those are the hypotheses that I spell out in this article, and that, you know, we'll have to wait 20 or 30 years and see whether Richard's right or whether I'm right. I hope I'm right. He probably hopes I'm right as well.
He said in parentheses, I hope not, about that. It kind of reminds me the night that Trump was elected, and I was at a election night watching party, and when it was very apparent Hillary Clinton was going down, and one of the people I was sitting with said, well, this looks like the end of capitalism as we know it. And I said, this is not the way I wanted it to happen. She says, yes, I know we needed a socialist revolution. But it was interesting to kind of look at that, because the thought of having Trump bring down the capitalist system is much scarier than having Bernie Sanders sort of attack it from a much more productive way. Do you see, though, that this could actually be threatening capitalism as we know it? I mean, it seems that there's a lot of changes. I mean, I've talked to other people on the show in the last few weeks about a shift in consciousness that's actually starting to talk about healthcare for all and talking about universal income, guaranteed income, and other issues that would have been not even considered a few months ago.
I think that's right. Of course, you know, we won't know for a long time. The first major result will be in November. But the third of my hypotheses is that the disease and resulting collapse is such a profound proof of our dependence on one another that it will it will lower the stock of the kind of rugged individualism that has dominated American culture and politics for a long time. Not that it will end it. Again, this is a matter of shifting things a few degrees, a few points either way, because we have a hyper-partisan, polarized population with completely separate and somewhat insular information systems that are feeding them. But, you know, just this is a disease that you can't keep yourself safe from unless other people keep themselves safe. Like, you literally can't do it on your own. You depend on there being strong institutions of public health, and you depend on other people keeping up their end of the bargain, maintaining the norms of distancing and hand washing and so on and so forth. And we're having the experience of the blue-collar workers being demonstrably the essential workers, plus doctors, and people, you know, people whose job it is to sit in an office and send email to each other. They're largely extraneous, right? They're not essential at all, but our society rewards them much more. So, and the social media exacerbates or amplifies strong emotion, right? That's the principal effect it has in our society and in our polity. So it amplifies hate, and we see that in the rise of the right in a number of countries, but it also amplifies the sense of connection to each other. I think that the response to the George Floyd murder, which is absolutely, you know, that's a lizard brain response. That's a deep down emotional thing. We're dealing with primary emotions here. This is not like someone developed a strategy and went out and asked people to go march in the streets. It just happened. There's a reaction because people watched that, and it is just patently unfair and not right. So I'm betting on the connective tissue growing stronger, and that could very well lead to improvements in the social safety net. Most prominently paid sick leave, I think that's the one that is emotionally most directly connected to the pandemic economic collapse. But it could easily lead to a bigger social safety net in other ways as well, including bigger investment in education, bigger investment in the healthcare system more generally, and perhaps even things like universal basic income. Certainly, the debate has moved way ahead from where it was, and the tide, if it washes Joe Biden into the White House, will push him to be more of an FDR figure than he, by his nature, would otherwise have been. Apparently he's talking every week with Elizabeth Warren because he needs some big ideas, right? The moment makes the leader. And so I could easily see that happening. I mean, we will, so much depends on what happens in November. And that's greatly unknown. You not only have to have Biden as the president, you also have to have big changes in the Senate. And those are less likely at this point than the White House flipping. I mean, Trump is just a singularly unpopular president. The single best predictor of a president's reelection is what's happened to the economy in the second quarter of his reelection year. So the second quarter is April, May, June. We're in the middle of it right now. The economy is in free fall, right? We are Goldman Sachs, which sort of the biggest marquee name of all capitalism, projects a 35% drop in GDP annualized in the second quarter of this year. So by that metric, the odds are that Trump will not get reelected. There's a big chance of dramatic changes in social and economic policy. I think the odds are that it's more likely to be better than worse. The other thing, though, about the American political system is that it's designed to slow down change. So, a sweeping change is hard to have happen. You'll have a few more ratchets upward in some programs and downward in others. You think about the Barack Obama victory was huge, and he had a filibuster-proof Senate majority, and he got just a couple things done, right? It's like you have to have both houses in Congress and the White House, and you have to be able to get past the Supreme Court and all the other federal courts, and then there are all these agencies that have their own powers and so on. And it's like a bus where there's a brake pedal at every seat. So change tends to happen much more slowly in the United States. It tends to stick. It tends to be more durable than in some other countries that have fewer of those veto points in the system. But I think it's likely we will have stronger social safety net because of greater social solidarity, but it'll be stepwise.
One of the things when you're talking about solidarity, and I'm thinking about how we have had this solidarity globally around, we're all experiencing this pandemic and we really need each other to keep ourselves safe. There's this other kind of solidarity that's bubbling up, actually like a geyser, around fighting racism. And there it also, though, defies the need for us to social distance. And so I wonder how we balance those two very strong needs.
Yeah, it's really worrisome. It's inevitable that all the protests have caused some, have been, some of them will probably turn out to have been super spreader events. And we'll have more. The survival rate among young people is really, really high. And so that doesn't worry me so much. It doesn't worry me for my kids to go out and protest. At 55, I'm mostly staying back. And as I was telling you, I berated my mother to stay in. So we should let the young people do the protest. And then a few of them will get the disease, but they'll recover and they'll be all right.
One of the things in talking in terms of solidarity that I've been finding really interesting is this onslaught of emails from every possible organization, including every environmental organization that I correspond with, who are standing up in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, including Sightline. I got an email from you the other day. Why do you think that is, and what does that mean? And I guess the other part of it is, how genuine do you think that these responses from all these organizations are?
I think they're probably genuine. I mean, I don't know about what, the companies that are making statements, whether they did some focus groups or something and figure out what their customer base likes. But, this is a defining moment. And though Sightline is not a work is not an organization that has worked on police reform or criminal justice reform, the racial and economic disparities and inequalities of our society are absolutely a central concern about how do we move towards sustainability, which is our mission as an organization to set an example in the Northwest of for sustainability. There is no way to serve our mission and stand on the sidelines in a at a moment like this. I just think it's another way of standing up is that everyone's sending out their notices, and like you said, we did it. But also, what we've been talking about as an organization is the need for us to step back a little bit, because we're a white-led organization with roots in the environmental movement, and this is not a time for us to seek a leadership role, rather to play a supportive role. So we have dramatically slowed down how much we're publishing. We're trying to amplify other voices, and we'll see how that goes. But you know, that's part of the change that we as a society and as a movement need to embrace, is that, you know, the demographics of the country are changing and the leadership of the country needs to keep up with that.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alan Durning with the Sightline Institute in Seattle about possible long-term consequences of the confluence of crises that we're now facing. Well, one of the things I find interesting, there's been a lot of protests in Southern Oregon. Now, Southern Oregon has been coming together to fight Jordan Cove LNG and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline for 15 years. And I was not surprised in a way. I think the first Southern Oregon demonstration was in Jackson County in Medford a couple days ago. But there's been protests in Klamath Falls, in Coos Bay, actually, and a bunch of other places. And Ashland's had some pretty big demos. And I'm going to be meeting tomorrow night with a number of people who are dealing with Jordan Cove, and we're doing this via Zoom, of course. And I'm very interested to hear from them how they feel that their struggle relates to the Black struggle. And they have been feeling really oppressed and dominated. Do you see these kind of intersections maybe actually strengthening collaboration between a lot of different forces and a lot of different sectors of our communities?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I think there's been a good amount of reaching out among different branches of different types of progressive change movements. I think that, you know, in 2008, I heard Van Jones give a talk where he said it feels like the floor has fallen out from under us and the roof has blown off from over us at the same time, and we're not sure if we're going to fall or we're going to fly. And it feels like that moment again. Every movement is trying to take care of its own people in the face of economic collapse and global pandemic, and adapt their strategies, figure out what do we do to stay relevant. Now, in the case of Jordan Cove and other major fossil fuel export proposals like the Klamath methanol plant or the Trans Mountain pipeline up in British Columbia, the economic collapse has helped us enormously, even while the federal governments have been working at cross purposes. That is, the Trump administration has been trying to accelerate the Jordan Cove plant, trying to do an end run around the state permitting process in Oregon. But the global economic collapse has eviscerated the demand for the product and shrunk substantially the investment funds available to build the things. I don't remember off the top of my head the price changes and how they affect the Jordan Cove, but I could talk about the Trans Mountain pipeline in British Columbia, which of course goes from Alberta from the tar sands to Burnaby just to the east of Vancouver, and it's already is a pipeline there, but there's a proposal to triple it in size, and the federal government bought the plan from the private developer of it about 3 years ago, 2 years ago now. It's now turned into a giant $12 billion project. And the whole point of it was to feed tar sands oil to the growing Asian market for oil. Well, what's happened is that the fuel prices have dropped so low that tar sands are basically worthless. So the $12 billion Canadian federal pipeline project is just an enormous white elephant, right? Tar sands oil last week in Alberta was selling for less than a pint of of Canadian maple syrup. It was, you know, it was like the same price as a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. You can't complete those projects when the market won't pay for the fuels. And the same is true, I think, for Kalama and for Coos Bay. Now, markets will adjust, will change again. But in the meantime, I think that the volatility is bad for the investment prospects for all these fossil fuel projects. I think that they help us, at least in the short term, at a tactical level. Over the long term, we're going to have to figure out how to keep those movements going to keep beating off the projects.
Another similarity I see in those struggles and the struggle against police violence is that most of all these pipelines, whether they're gas or oil, are going through Indigenous territory. And it's been a big fight that's been, in a lot of places, has been led by Indigenous people who are as marginalized as anybody in America. And I wonder if you see connections there between the way that these people have been treated historically and how that this may be a way also to strengthen their fight and to give them, not just to stop the pipelines, but also to start really focusing on the needs that these communities have and the injustices that have been done to them.
Yeah, that's, Barbara, I think that's a really important point. You know, the leadership of most of the fossil fuel fights have been from Indigenous communities. The Trans Mountain Pipeline fight, and then the other pipeline fight further north in British Columbia, the name of which is escaping me at the moment, the Indigenous communities have been absolutely in front, putting their bodies in the way of construction. And that led, in fact, to a giant wave in Canada of sort of solidarity protests across the country last summer, slowing down a whole bunch of projects and delaying the whole thing delaying the construction projects in many cases by a year. Just long enough for the economic collapse to undermine the value proposition for investors of completing these things. So these fights are completely connected. You know, going back, the Black Lives Matter movement and the way that helped to inspire the Idle No More movement among Canadian First Nations and to a certain extent in the United States. The fossil fuel fights, I think they're all connected and strengthening one another. But it's also a period of incredible, you know, unknowns, right? So many of our tribal communities in the United States are suffering collapses of their traditional revenue sources. The COVID infection, the coronavirus infection rates are exceptionally high in tribal communities in the United States. So, like Van Jones said, it's, you know, the roof is blown off and the floor is falling out at the same time. And it's a time of enormous opportunity and enormous peril.
Well, one of the things that inspires me in a very unique way is I've heard several young protesters, and most of them are people of color, though I think some of them were white, who are talking about the risk that they're taking violating social distancing needs to go to these protests. And particularly some of the protesters of color are talking about how it's worth risking their lives, that they would die for this cause. And I feel this is a very genuine sentiment that's coming from these young people. And it feels very empowering to me. Do you see that this may also be a new direction? It might be a harbinger of a new direction that our society is going in.
It could be, Barbara. I sure hope so. You know, both Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln had premonitions of their own death, and they both reported to their contemporaries that they found it liberating, that accepting that we are here just as mortal beings temporarily, and that the meaning of our life comes from serving others, serving greater causes, set them free to be more courageous and lead others. And so hearing what you're saying about protesters, that good for them, right? They can be more powerful leaders that way.
So in the near future, since we've been talking so much about the far future, what do you see in the near future? And basically, how are you shaping your own life right now to kind of deal with what you see before you?
Yeah, well, quickly, like within a week of the first death from COVID in North America, which happened just north of Seattle, Sightline and its staff moved to remote work. We got that taken care of pretty quickly. We had to cancel all our in-person events, including a major pro-housing event conference that we were planning this spring in Portland. Once we'd made those adaptations, we turned to all of our strategies and have reworked them all. So, for example, we were getting ready to publish a book on ways to fix American democracy without having to wait for a change in the Supreme Court or a constitutional amendment. And we put the whole book on hold because we realized that the one thing we could do that would make the biggest difference right now is to help advance vote by mail in states outside of the Northwest, using the expertise that Oregon and Washington have developed from doing that over the last couple of decades. So we've spun up a whole program with now, gosh, almost half of our staff working on it to help county election officials in a dozen battleground states and activists in those states as well to just figure out the concrete particulars, the nitty-gritty details of, you know, where do you get the right kind of paper that makes the right thickness of ballots that the machines can read, and how do you put the barcodes on the envelope so that you can get them processed in time, and all those details that Washington, Oregon have figured out. And I should say that our election officials in Washington, Oregon, of both parties, have been super helpful in that, eager to share their expertise. So we've just been trying to adapt to what are the immediate opportunities and priorities available to us. And that's been one of the biggest things. And it's been inspiring just to see the degree to which people are adapting, rising to the challenge. And the primary elections that have been conducted in other states have mostly been encouraging in terms of the ability of the election system to respond. You know, the great fear is that the November election is marred by irregularities that allow the right to delegitimize the results of the election. That's my greatest fear, because I think that the electorate will expel the toxin in November if we can run a fair election. I'm a congenital optimist.
What's your greatest hope?
My greatest hope, I think, is that the November elections lead to a 2021 that proves a turning point in U.S. history, in the way that the FDR election led to the New Deal, or the way that the assassination of John F. Kennedy led to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, right? Like, tragedy can lead to good things. It depends on the leadership we have and whether we can seize the moment. And I think that's entirely possible now. It's up to us to steer things in the best direction we can.
Well, Alan, it's really good to talk to you and keep up the good work that you and Sightline are doing.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been an honor. Take good care of yourself.
You too. Thanks a lot. Today, we've been talking with Alan Derning with the Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic forced us to cancel our spring pledge drive, but you can still help us through these difficult times if you are able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about what all the action in the streets is all about and what we need to do to seriously confront systemic racism here in Portland and across the nation. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands. Spend it all. The have-nots. Money. We make it. Before we see it, you take
Bills pile up.